So we've talked, well, perhaps since we're dealing with the period of the 50s, perhaps both of you can recall when you became aware that Isaiah was going to marry Aline. I mean, when this saga first loomed up into visibility.
I remember I was astonished. I thought of Isaiah as a sort of archetypal bachelor. I couldn't imagine that he would get married.
Yes.
An archetypal bachelor living in college, never imagining, never doing anything else. Yes. I was astonished when I heard about it. Thought it rather a bad idea, not doing Aline.
Yes. So, thought it a bad idea, why?
Well, I thought he would uproot him from his kind of happy life in living in college.
Yes.
But I was quite wrong, of course. It's a very, very good idea.
I was interested in your remark that when he was in Moscow, you sometimes had the impression, and Aline sometimes had the impression, that he rather forgot that he had a wife.
Wife. Well, that was very early days, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he did. I remember him setting off the library and being very sweetly saying, well, when you be back, what about me? What we came to do?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
I've never seen him other than get on. Obviously, because I think partly Aline's enormous skills.
Yes.
Incredible.
She's an extraordinary woman.
Yes.
And she must have made it. I mean, it's wonderfully agreeable, the life she made for him at that Eddington house. Oh, it's so beautifully run. And it's so it's wonderful, the background for him,
yes.
Ideal existence for him, really. Couldn't have been better.
She's extraordinary, isn't she? Because she's an athlete, a golf as well.
Yes. She's a very graceful woman, and also very, I often feel, I'm not the world's natural biographer, but when I retrace the steps by which this began to happen, I see Aline's very indirect kind of touching of the tiller occasionally.
Yes.
It's a very odd way in which she said to me, you know, it would be a terrible shame if all this wonderful talk was lost.
Yes.
So the initial thing that started it was that I simply came with my tape recorder and tape recorded.
Oh, good.
And then as the years went by, and many years did go by, I mean three or four, he finally said, well, we've got to do something. By which time her design, as it were, had been accomplished. But in many ways it was her her suggestion,
yes.
Not mine and not his.
Really, that's interesting. Yes, that's really not surprising, but interesting.
Why do you think they this is a sort of difficult thing to talk about, but why do you think they work as a couple?
Well, I think because she's prepared, in a way, to accommodate herself to his way of life.
Yes.
I think she's...
She's the one who's made the compromise.
She's the one who makes the compromise. Like she accepts that Isaiah is as he is and fits her life around it successfully and makes it better for him and easier for him. And it must be very stimulating and agreeable for her too. It brings a lot of nice people which otherwise might not meet. But I think basically because she accommodates herself to him that it works, I would think.
Yeah.
She accepts that Isaiah is as he is. One must live with it.
What do you think about that?
I agree with that. I think she's willingly makes the framework. And Isaiah just luxuriates in
the
marvelous world. Which
yes.
No, he wouldn't. No, I visualize Isaiah living permanently either in New College or in All Souls as a kind of typical bachelor don whose life is within a college.
With the other,
people flock to worship and all that, but that he would be looked after by scouts and people and so on.
Yeah.
Have no family life.
Yeah.
And it's quite turned out quite differently and much better.
Yeah. Let's resume this narrative. You come back in 57 and then you...
Well, then Isaiah changed my life because we were staying with them in Eddington and And I went to dinner without Iris, went to dinner also. It was tonight, it was for dinner of Adley Stevenson, I think. And Oliver Franks was there.
What's the date here?
This must be about sometime early 58, I think.
Yes.
And Oliver Franks went home early. We were talking about him. And I said, Oliver had been off the Queen's and gone off to be ambassador in Washington. And I said, I can't imagine anyone having choice of being head of Oxford College or being an ambassador, choosing to be an ambassador. Then anyone offered me the wardenship of New College and the embassy in Washington at the same time, which nobody had. I should choose New College. This is kind of often a remark one makes to please one's host without having very seriously thought about it at all. And as I said, do you know that the warden of New College is about to retire and looking for an outside appointment? I said, no, I know I know about any of that, which I hadn't.
Yeah.
And they said, do you mean it seriously? And I said, oh, well, no, I don't know, perhaps. Can we give it a run, said Isaiah. So I said, oh, well, I can't see any harm in that. So I was approached and asked down to dinner and so on. But I didn't really think it was really going to happen much. I all hoped it would, but I didn't think it would. And then Isaiah, as usual, first with the news, rang me up and said, they're going to appoint you. And I said, well, I must think if I really want it or not. I said, it's far too late, said Isaiah, you're committed. You. So I was, and that was, and that was, but that was, I mean, it changed my, I was only 52, so I wasn't reaching retiring age. I had no idea other than I wasn't going to go on the Foreign Office until I got to the retiring age, which is 60.
Yes.
But anyway, there it was. And I've never regretted it, but
Do you think he campaigned on your behalf?
He did. Yes. He told them. They never would have thought of me or I of them. But I put the idea into their heads and into mine. And then David Sissel rather ran the campaign. But I think Isaiah did a lot of backstage stuff of various kinds.
Yes. Why was it that you were so certain that between the choice of New College and being an ambassador in Washington, your priorities were so clear to you?
Well, I wasn't quite certain, actually. It was kind of often a remark pleasing one's audience, you see, audience. I wasn't absolutely certain.
Yeah.
But I must say, the more I thought about it, the more I thought it would be very nice.
Yes.
And I thought it would be, we'd been moving around so much, it would be nice to fix somewhere for some time. I knew I could be there if I wanted for 18 years, which indeed I was.
Yeah.
And I knew it was a lovely house, and I thought we had friends in Oxford and would have more. And they remember. But I'd have actually been off in Washington. I never was, of course. I had been, I might have hesitated rather more.
Yes.
But anyway.
Did you feel rather the same way?
Oh,
so I remember coming up often and telling you this had been suggested. And you said it's an entrancing prospect, I remember you saying.
One of the things that's rather odd about Isaiah, though, by comparison, is that you could tell a story about him in relation to Oxford, that he's rather fleed or run away from institutional position in the place. I mean, there was a period in the early 50s when Nuffield knocked and he turned them away. There were periods when All Souls, he might have had a run at the wardenship, he turned that way. There were other periods in which he seems to have...
Well, yes, I mean, I was extremely surprised when he was... I heard he was thinking of Wilson.
Yes.
I thought he was quite out of character.
Yes.
I thought he'd always rejected administrative posts of all kinds. And I didn't think of him as an administrator at all. And I thought, I even said to him, I thought it was a bad idea. I said, well, I said, belong to give up lecturing. I hate lecturing. He lectured marvellously, you know, it was wonderful.
Yes.
But he apparently hated it, he worried him very much. And that was his way of getting out of lecturing. I don't know whether that was the real reason, but he advanced it as a reason. And of course it turned out very well because he didn't have to do much administering. He attracted funds like kind of money poured in because he was Isaiah.
Yes.
And all the administration was done by Michael Brock.
Yes.
Who was very good at it. was a very good combination, really. And they've got the thing off the ground very, very successfully.
In some ways, his saying he didn't want to lecture anymore, I think, had something to do with the feeling that that intellectually, that was enough. He had reached the point where he didn't want to.
Yes, I think it may be, yes.
A certain intellectual line, and yes. He wanted to change.
Yes, he wanted to change, yes. I suppose so. I mean, I think his lectures were wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
And they were attracted huge crowds always. Yeah. But apparently, he always said he hated it and it made him nervous.
Oh, yeah.
It's a way of looking up the corner of the room, not daring to meet anyone's eye.
Yeah.
So it's very extraordinary.
What dealings institutionally did you have with him as head of house at Oxford?
I don't remember we had anything very much. I don't think we were. Yeah, houses, heads of houses, they hardly ever meet, really. And as such, I mean, as a body, they meet individually, separately.
Yeah.
I don't remember having any sort of contact with him as head of house. Clearly it was a very great success.
Yeah.
Everyone adored him. They have a wonderful figure to have about the place.
Yeah.
And as I say, the money poured in, and it was great. Meant great prestige. College became a very prestigious, interesting place because I was the head of it.
Yes.
And it was very well administered by Michael.
Yes.
So that was perfectly all right, really. It was it's been a very successful college, I think.
I've always been rather impressed by Isaiah's the degree of self-knowledge required to realize that you're a hopeless administrator and
yes.
You better get somebody decent
yes.
to do
it. Yes. Yes.
Many slightly more megalomaniac characters
yes.
might think I can do it all. And
no,
he clearly understood he couldn't.
No, he's not a megalomaniac at all, as though. He's perfectly well aware, I think, of his own abilities and
yes.
limitations,
yes.
which exist. I think the same reason that we were saying about, I think he would soon realize that the Foreign Office was not for him. He wouldn't have been happy there.
Yes.
Wouldn't have done it well.
Yes.
It wouldn't have been a good thing to stay on.
This is a sort of general question. Being a sort of hopeless biographer and not very good interviewer, I can't formulate it the right way, but I just wanted a sort of sense of someone who was at Oxford from the late 50s through the 60s and the 70s. This is a period of Isaiah's maximum kind of fame as a kind of Oxford character.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering whether you can assemble what the ingredients of that fame were, why it is he was such a great figure in Oxford.
Well, it's because he is who he is. I mean, the conversation is the main thing, I think. I mean, he's a wonderful company, wonderful talk. It enlivens everyone's life very much. Everyone wants to talk to Isaiah.
Yeah.
Have Isaiah talk to them, really.
Yeah.
It's a great thing. And it's a wonderful flow of ideas, of extraordinary associations never thought of, really, which once you as I formulate them, you realize that they are true and important.
Yes.
And it's a sort of wonderful turn, really. And it's illuminating when we're meeting by that.
Do you sometimes think it'll all die when he dies? That is to say, it's so much dependent on the effect of his personality.
Well, I think and you have an important task to perform. I mean, Dr. Johnson survives not from his writings, but because Boswell describes his personality and his talk. And the same could be done for Isaiah.
Yes.
But I think there is a danger that it will disappear. I mean, there's Maurice Barrett, for instance, you see, was nothing but talk. His books are unreadable.
Yes.
But his talk is wonderful.
Yes.
Isaiah's not. Books aren't unreadable, they're much better than that.
Yes.
But they're not as good as his talk, really. And there's a danger.
I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. I think that there are some aspects of his work that will not survive him, but there are others where...
No, I think that...
I think he achieves... There is a kind of eloquence in his writing, and sometimes
there is
a degree of penetration. And then there's something about his range.
Yes.
I don't want
to decry. Well, I think they're excellent, but they're not as super excellent
as his talk.
Some of his books are writings are beyond me, but some of them are wonderful, I think, wonderfully interesting, fascinating. Philosophical writings are too difficult for me, but I'm not a philosopher. But his biographical ones are very remarkable, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, no, there's only his. He's beautiful, I mean, it's beautifully written, really. But, I mean, Morris's books are dead. Well, no one ever read any books Morris wrote again, ever. Some of Isaiah's books will continue to be read, I think, for a long time.
But isn't it, one of the central difficulties I have, that perhaps you can both help me with, is that he's such an un-English figure in many ways, and has done so well in English life. I can never figure out the sense in which he's an insider or an outsider in English life.
I think he's curiously very much an insider. Although he's so exotic in a way, he's an absolute complete feel for the shape of English, fabric of English life. He understands it perfectly, I think. And I regard him very much an insider, I would say. I think he absolutely fits into the overworthy establishment. Part of it, really, without any kind of official position. Anyone with who lists the sort of important, I mean, he must be thought of as one of the major living Englishmen by people, anyone serious. And people think of him as an Englishman. I don't think they think of him as an exotic foreigner. In spite of his exotic name and appearance and background, he seems to have become very English somehow.
Did you feel slightly intimidated by him?
But the great thing, he's very unlike Morris in that sense. Morris Barrow didn't like anyone, liked monologue. And if he couldn't think of anything, he'd go, humba, 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 until he was ready for the next remark. He didn't want anyone to get into the conversation. Isaiah likes it. The ball batted back. He doesn't want to monopolize. Likes the dialogue, I think.
Yes.
Morris likes the monologue.
He's a good listener, though. Many people wonder just how well Isaiah listens.
I think he's become less of a good listener as he gets in the latter years. Well, I mean, when I first knew him, I felt we were sort of on conversation was more or less to and fro. We would.
Yes.
Now I think he tends to
go on a bit,
a little more than he used to. Naturally, inevitably, I think.
Your comparisons with Barrow are exceedingly interesting to me, because one of the difficulties of doing this book is just recreating a vanished Oxford.
Yes.
Because I have a sense of it vanishing.
Yes.
He's a product of particularly an Oxford of the 30s, which no longer exists, that produced these extraordinary characters like Barrow and
Sparrow.
And Sparrow.
Yes. Well, there may be some of that kind, but we don't know, but I certainly don't know of any of them. Comparable volubility and sort of polymath kind of person. I can't
get any sense of Sparrow.
Well, Sparrow I've known since we were both 12. We shared digs and so on. He was very ruthless, very amusing, outrageous figure. But when we were sharing rooms together,
really?
When we shared rooms, he picked up a letter from somebody else. To read other people's letters is permissible. To read their postcards is obligatory.
That catches the ruthlessness.
The ruthlessness. Another wonderful occasion. The absurd institution, the university sermon, the two have to preach every year, one on the sin of pride, the other on humility. John was preaching the one on the sin of pride, and he said, well, pride is very different from vanity, and there are two people very well known to all of us here, one of whom symbolizes pride, and the other vanity. Like, we all look very anxious at one another. We were going to be singled out. And he said, pride is the lesser deadlock in Bleak House, and vanity is the Walter Elliot in Persuasion.
That's very good.
That's a typical sort of John behavior, really.
Yeah,
and he was very funny. A very funny man. And he was a ruthless homosexual. He was kind of always great difficulty keeping him away from the young men.
Yes.
So, and that was a problem with that. And later, because he took to drinking very big way, and it was a very sad end. But he was a very good company, very amusing, very engaging, very ruthless, and very funny. Very, very reactionary, from tremendously right-wing views. Sort of right-wing radical of a god kind.
Yes.
I remember that same university sermon, the preacher has to read out a sort of bidding prayer, which includes the royal family. And he said, our gracious majesty the Queen, Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, and Charles, Prince of Wales. Charles, Prince of Wales, then quite young, been brought to see him, and he'd fallen deeply in love with him, I think. He was a remarkable character, really.
Do you think Isaiah and Sparrow were ever, I mean, they went back forever to the...
Yes,
you know,
they did, oh yes, all sales.
How close were they, do you think?
Oh, they were great friends, I think, yes. Yeah. Isaiah was, I think, worried by him and sort of felt he had to hold him back from his excesses from time to time. But they were, I thought they were very close, I think they were very fond of each other and they enjoyed each other's company very much, I think. Have you seen John Sparrow's little poem about Morris Barra?
Yes, yes.
Wonderful, it's right, really good. Yes.
I'm wondering, one of the most difficult things, this is really my last question, the most difficult problem I have as a biographer is to get a sense of development with Isaiah.
Yes.
To get a sense of how he's changed over time, what aging has done to him, how he's developed. Because there is a story that he's really always been pretty much the same. I'm just wondering whether you have a thought about all that.
I think he's... Yes, I think he's hardened a little laterally. He's become more of a monologue and more cut off from people than that in a few years. But I must say, I think before that he's been, ever since I've known him, which is quite a long time, he has been much the same. He's, this great flow of talk was there, and it's the same kind of very amusing, very enjoyable talk. But I don't know that it changed its nature very much over the years. I've known him until lately when I say I think he has, well, I don't know, I don't see him so much now as I used to.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. I feel he's, you know, his life is so very... We live a very quiet life here, I never go to London. And so on. His life tends to be a lot in London now, I think. And we just haven't... I mean, whenever we see each other, as friends as we ever were, but we just don't see each other very often now.
Yes.
But I'm devoted to both. I'm devoted to Aline. I love her dearly, and I'm very fond of Isaiah, too, in quite a different way. But as I say, we don't somehow see them quite as often as we used to. Not from any drawing back on our side, I don't think. But I think Isaiah somehow is not around so much as he used to be. And I've moved out of Oxford. I'm in the country. We don't meet in the street or anything that we might have done before. And so we stop and talk when we do, but we don't.
Making plans gets much
lazier and lazier about making plans. Yeah. Well, when we've got a delightful conductor who lives in this village who's conducting Covent Garden, and we asked them to lunch in Berlin, and that came and it was lovely, it went very well. But we don't often make plans like that now.
Yes.
So we're getting much more lazy about social life. No, I've lost my voice. I should give it up altogether, I think.
But Isaiah really was interested in most people, even
like
boring people.
What do
you think?
Yes.
Oh, I think he is.
He's much more tolerant of many great
yeah.
men.
Yeah, so much. So he's quite willing to talk to anybody, I think.
Well, David Hockney always tells this rather funny story of painting or drawing Isaiah to sitting in some studio in New York or wherever he was. And Isaiah's talking a kind of quiet, slow kind of subterranean burble that goes on and on and on to Hockney, and they're talking about art and painting. At which point, David Hockney's cleaning lady comes kind of at 90 degrees across the room, whereupon Isaiah starts talking to her in the same subterranean world about the cleaning fluids that she's using and talking about her life, and she's drawn into the conversation. It goes on and on and on. There is a sort of omnivorous curiosity there, which is rather has its attractive side.
Oh, very. I think he loves arranging things. He loves Oxford intrigue and Oxford activities.
Yeah, well, your story is a classic story of how the business is done.
The business is done, exactly. Yes. 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 Extremely English, I think. I never think of him as other than English somehow, with all these sort of cosmopolitan connections, Israel and America and France and all the rest. He seems to me as a quintessentially English figure he's become, oddly enough.
That's a very interesting observation. I think it's true, although I think he feels that there's always a kind of margin that will remain.
Well, like I say, I mean, the mere fact of being Jewish is slightly, but I was given an English Jew rather than, and then a sort of cosmopolitan Jew. And I think, I mean, his Jewishness is very much part of him, I think, and he has all the great qualities of that great race. He's very conscious of it, aware of it. But he's an admirable figure, I think. I think he's done a lot to enliven and enrich our lives in this country, especially his own acquaintances, friends.
I'm not looking forward to writing about him, since it's extremely difficult.
Very difficult thing to do. I'm glad to hear you say that you recorded a lot of his conversation.
I'm going to see him this afternoon, for example.
Yes.
We just mostly just gossip, but occasionally I try and jog him along a certain track.
Yes. But even sort of gossip is splendid, I think. And he does love gossip, and unmalicious. He's not malicious at all, I think. But he's quite sharp, time to time.
Yeah.
No, I agree.
I wanted to ask you one thing, for absolutely nothing, but apropos of MacLean and Burgess and Philby and all this stuff, is that he's quite good friends with Burgess from the 30s, and it's Burgess who persuades him to go to
Moscow. Yes.
In Moscow in 40.
Yes.
would you have agreed to any suggestion by Guy Burgess of a professional nature? I mean, it's a sort of odd thing.
Very odd.
You could have done.
I only knew Burgess after the war, when he was working in the Foreign Office for Hector MacLean. I could never see any charm there at all. But he clearly did charm people. When he was younger, he charmed all sorts of people. And he must have had a certain seduction, which wasn't apparent to me when he's in his later years. I'm surprised that he should have, but then I say I only knew him later on, I wouldn't have, I agree with you, it is rather surprising. He obviously was an amusing character, and he's talked about the things that I interested in, I saw, and in an amusing way, I suppose. But I agree with you, it is rather surprising. He should have been seduced by them. I knew all that, and I met Philby once, and I knew MacLean quite well, and I knew Bertie slightly. MacLean, I'm not surprised you're all taken in by him. Darling, would you better turn over that wireless one? Put the wireless right way up, otherwise we shan't be able to bring this.
Well, thank you for this. I think I'll stop.